Now I can say hello to the World Wide Web. So back in the fall of 98, okay, we promised that this software would be put on the web, which it was by about June. Anyone who owns a dustbuster, owns a pet wombat, Eric will talk more about wombats, or goes to these websites. So the data is there. I want to emphasize that the software for evaluating all of these equations for any of our dust models along any line of sight is also there, because half of the people in this room have emailed me to ask the details of how to evaluate these equations. It's all in there. You don't have to do a thing. Okay, moving down to TOCO, which is what I'm supposed to be talking about. It's great CMB data, really, but it's also a great test of these predictions. All right, the FIRAS data get really ratty as far as ISM is concerned, below about 300 or 400 gigahertz. So at 140 gigahertz, TOCO really provides an opportunity to see if we did anything right. So the TOCO team was kind enough to provide me with the data back in January, and I made some maps just doing the simplest things, the quadratic baseline subtraction from each of these sweeps. Actually, linear is probably good enough. You end up with stripy maps anyway. You do a little bit of Fourier filtering to take that out. Because if you imagine your map and taking a Fourier transform over your map, all those stripes, all the things you do wrong, are a relatively small fraction of the wave numbers. You measure all the other wave numbers properly, so you might as well use them. Okay, various rejection algorithms. We ended up using about 40% of the data to make these maps. And they look like this. I have to show one thing at a time here. So this is the TOCO D-band A horn, also known as D1. And this is a projection, just a simple Cartesian projection here over the hour, the right ascensions of interest. Declination minus 65 to 55. And you see the galactic plane cutting through. You see some bright spots from known H2 regions. And you see stripes. I don't know. Do you see stripes? Okay, good. You make some stripes go away. It looks better on the computer screen, sorry. You look at the prediction, which doesn't have enough noise in it. And the beams aren't actually matched properly, but that's the difference. Data minus prediction. So just looking at this part of it, you'd say, woohoo, we're done. And then we came to these guys. All right, so those are H2 regions like Eta Carinae and so on. Oh, by the way, here's the other D horn of TOCO. Same deal, resolution's a little worse. Scanning a different range and declination, too, so that worst spot is just off the map here. Yeah, right. The baseline removal happened to both. Exactly. This went through all the steps, the 480 striping, everything, exactly like the data. Okay. Even the sub-pixel weightings are exactly the same. I was careful to do the comparison fairly. Okay, now if you just make a simple scatter plot, the prediction and the observation looks nice. This line is not a fit, it's a slope of 1. Okay. And then the bright spots give you little rays of points going off at other angles. So those are clearly wrong, and they're off by some coefficient in general. But I think the general agreement, if you get rid of those, they're sticking out on both sides here, you're left with a cluster of points that agree very nicely with the prediction. And I just want to recall here that if nu squared were the correct emissivity law for dust, these would look like that. Okay. We've been preaching for well over a year that it's not nu squared, and every talk I go to, everyone says, nu squared. You just can't do that. So in our paper, we discuss the empirical measurements of Egladze et al. They do laboratory measurements of various kinds of amorphous silicates. And it's amazing that you can find silicates with almost any property you want. Emissivity laws from 1.2 to far above 2. And those are coming from the fact that they're amorphous. There are these two-level tunneling systems where an atom's sitting in a funny spot in the grid that isn't a grid, and it can kind of jump between two different positions. Doesn't have much preference for either. There's not much energy difference. So at very low energies, you have an emissivity mechanism that has nothing to do with the usual crystalline silicate things. So I don't know if you believe any of this, but these are the physical explanations that... Yeah, it is the usual problem. So, fractal grains. Yeah. So, I'm just making an empirical statement that it doesn't look much like nu squared. So, all right. And as far as predicting foregrounds for CMB experiments, that's all we care about. It would be obviously nice to understand the underlying physics. Okay, as far as our disagreements between Tocco and the predictions, Tocco is wrong in a few places because... No, the predictions are wrong. although it's interesting to note here that our agreement with Tocco, without any fudging around, is within 10%. So if their peak is high because the overall flux calibration is wrong, then, you know, our model's wrong too. But it's just kind of a neat coincidence that they're both wrong by the same amount. That's just... because I'm masking out anything around zero. All right, so that makes it look a bit noisier, but you aren't supposed to take anything away from this plot except that average temperature of the ISM, prediction good. High temperature, prediction bad. That's all. Now, why is that? These H2 regions are so substantial that there might be free even way out here at 150 gigahertz. That's stretching things a bit. But if the same sources in the 30 and 40 gigahertz TOCO maps are actually free, and you keep extrapolating, you get something that accounts for a third or maybe a half of that emission, of the extra emission that the TOCO sees on top of what we predicted. Okay, so it's important to remember that we're not just looking at the thermal tail of the dust. Now, for the other 50% of the disagreement, is it a bad temperature correction? Okay, so when you look along a line of sight that has multiple temperatures, and you assume there's only one, you always underpredict the column of dust. The way to think about it is you have some cold dust sitting there not emitting very much, and then the hot dust shining, you say, oh, it's hot, I better correct down from 100 microns. So that's in the right sense. Now, part of the reason for that may relate to the distortions in our map. Okay, we made these nice projections for use at high latitude with the galactic plane put in a circle around the edge, and we did everything on them. Because the whole point of this map was to make an extinction map. We never even thought anyone would seriously look at it in the plane. So you get this. Here's the Tocco region again. Sorry, that looks better on the computer screen. The galactic plane comes through, and the PSF is elongated in that direction. So what I spent the last week doing was regenerating all the maps using Helix, which is what we should have. Chris isn't here. going to give a great advertisement for HealPix, because then we can do the smoothing and all the steps of the processing without any distortion of the point spread function. Well, a lot less, right. Okay, and then another thing to think about is that maybe, you know, we have this temperature information on big scales, like 1.3 degrees from Derby. We had to smooth it that much to match the PSFs there. So what if you use the IRAS 60 to 100 micron ratio for temperature? Okay, before Ned cringes too much, let me just show. Here we have Derby 60 to 100 ratio, 100 to 140. Okay, these X's are nu squared times a black body evaluated at different temperatures. I just said it's not nu squared, but when you're talking about things near the peak of the dust emission, it's not so far off. And the point is, multiplying by nu or 1 or any of the other favorite power laws does not move these around anywhere near where the points are. So this is just the well-known statement that the 60 micron emission in the Derby and IRAS maps is mostly not thermal emission from the dust from a single temperature big grain component. Now, of course, you have smaller transiently heated grains, all kinds of other things going on. The question is, does it correlate well enough that you can establish an empirical relationship and then bootstrap off of this ratio at high angular resolution and recover something that's much better than our 100 to 240 micron temperature map? Because then you could do temperature, you could trace temperature variations on 6 to 10 arc minute kind of scales instead of 1 to 2 degree scales. Sure. Oh, this is confined to the galactic plane where you have some signal noise at 140. These are all so bright, it doesn't matter. I'm sorry, but we're looking at things that are hundreds of megajanskis here. You know. This is probably our model, but I'm sure if you do it with the Goddard model, it's no different. So if you didn't use a zodiacal model, it probably wouldn't even be noticeable. Then you can also do the same thing, median filtered, again, throwing away anything that's too close to 0/0. And here the zodiacal model really doesn't matter. And these things, you know, there is a relationship there. So I've spent some time working on this, but I don't yet have a 60 to 100 micron IRAS temperature map that I believe. But give me another month. It's kind of a mess, but I think it is possible. Okay, and then just going around the sky here, galactic center and anti-center and 90 degrees off from those, the relationship does not vary as you go around the sky. Off the plane, the zodiacal light matters, and the 60 micron ratio, I mean the 60 micron IRAS data is very difficult to deal with because the zodiacal light really does come in booming in at 60 microns. So off the plane, I'm not sure this would be useful. Yeah, so this is not helpful for the CME. Why am I talking about this? No, this is helpful to just try to establish that we understand what's going on in the plane well enough that we can actually hope we understand the other. Because I think the 100 to 240 micron ratio map, I think that's fine if you're out in the ISM somewhere where there's not much going on, there's not a big H2 region, the temperature is fairly uniform. It should be okay. We have a figure in our first paper that shows how broad the temperature variation has to get before you make more than a 10% error. And it's really pretty broad. So that sounds like a naive assumption, but it's be the central limit theorem or something. Okay, so the conclusions here. So Is it noon? Okay. So we agree reasonably well as can be expected with Toko. And maybe Andrew will point out with Maxima and Boomerang and others, except in these pesky regions, and might be able to do something about that with IRAS. But in the meantime, I just want to drive home the point that CMB projects also provide a lot of insight into the ISM, and this is the only good way we have to figure out what is the total column of dust in a certain region, independent of temperature, because you're on the Rayleigh Jeans tail. Okay. As far as spinning dust goes, I'll leave that to Angelica, because I haven't found it yet. All right. Any questions? Well, I looked at 30 and 42, and we had a big project at Green Bank at 5 to 10 gigahertz that found 1-3 sigma result out of so many that you would expect to find 1-3 sigma result. So, not for lack of trying, I can't. We chose filaments so that they wouldn't just be compact sources that are hard to deal with. And then we scanned across the filaments, chopped back and forth. We took the 140-foot telescope and we made it chop. Well, this was about a month before it shut down. and their staff came out and first they scolded us for even thinking about moving the telescope that fast, and for rewriting the control software so that it could. And then they said if they weren't going to shut it down in a month, they would have already like shipped us out and refused to let us ever come to Green Bank again. But we did the best we could and didn't see a thing. So I don't know where the spinning dust is.
But if you look off the plane, the most one template that correlates with that is dust.
So which map you said 19 gigahertz?
The Cottingham
stuff, yeah.
The most, I mean, nothing correlates with it. Think of fun. I mean, any, I, you know, please agree, no one knows about this. But
yeah. And it's also about 50 times brighter than any of these models would predict for straight dust emission, so it would have to be spinning dust, right?
But 5 gigahertz is, spinning dust is pretty faint.
Right. Right. Well, I haven't done a careful enough analysis yet because I don't have the beams matched exactly the way I want to. I think if it's there, it's a few percent. I don't know what limits you're going to give. But. So does it look like Derby more than just the fact that it looks like cosecant D?
Yeah.
All right.
It's
and this is 30 gigahertz data? Oh, 10 and 15. Well, it's interesting. Interesting problem. Eric.
So Doug, 10% accuracy prediction is pretty impressive across that extrapolation. So I'm trying to get a sense of whether that's good enough. Could you subtract?
Oh, well, it's not going to get better. It depends what frequency you're working at. Right? You're not going to look for CMB at 500 gigahertz. So at 150, I don't think the dust is actually a serious problem in most places.
But there are people who are planning
to do experiments with, say, 150 and 240 and 350. And so
you've got a lot of frequency.
And that's the best thing to do, of course.
Well,
I think that's what you want to do, as long as you have signal noise so that you aren't adding a lot more noise in by doing so. Right. but certainly a multi-frequency approach where you're measuring the dust with the same instrument that you're measuring the CMB with would be the best thing. Okay, if you go too high, you run out of signal noise on FIRAS, right? It's pretty bad anyway per frequency bin, but at high latitude there's nothing. So we considered the following regions: the entire sky observed by FIRAS, the part of the sky used in the Kogut paper to do the DMR stuff, remember a couple of years ago, the correlation of DMR with dust. We used that cut, and then we used a cut that I sort of empirically determined kept, you know, still a conservatively high latitude, but enough signal to get a decent answer. Yeah, it's meant to be excluding the plane. Oh, well, just as a toy model, I said suppose there's a Gaussian distribution of temperatures along each line of sight. And as you make that broad, if you do bimodal, you get something similar, though, in the limit where the temperatures aren't 5 and 30.
Right.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay, I didn't say, so you're referring to the Reach et al. Paper in 95. Or older, okay, but ideas of that kind. Right et al., right. So that is a good fit to the data. As I recall, though, it's fitting the temperatures for the two components along every line of sight, right? And they're allowed to float with respect to each other.
Well, I didn't do that, but no. That's
okay, well, Bill did that. Right. Right. Yeah.
So if you're different power levels, you can still get this shoulder of that without requiring such a wide dispersion in either the near-stellar medium or the physical properties of the dust.
And the temperatures are still different. They're kind of 10-ish and 16-ish Kelvin. But 5 and 20 is hard.
Certainly not a component in any of the fire ass fitting I was doing, because the
you recorded
astrophotic emission
Right. Yeah, I think we just found that less believable, that there could be such a range in intensities than that there's different emissivities. Especially when the Igladze paper, now you can debate what exactly they did, but they claim they find these properties in real materials. Also, the ratios of optical to far infrared, those numbers agree with their empirical observations. So. Sure, but nobody ever claims to have done an empirical measurement in the lab where they can show how you get 1,000 times difference in radiation field, right? Well, I know, but I don't know. That just seems like it would require magic.
You're not sure of the shape of the particles in experimental lab. I mean, if it were just slabs of this stuff, you'd pick up the tunnel and see differences as they occur. See symmetries and
stuff. Yeah, well, the slabs would be much better controlled than the usual smoke.
Yeah, sure.
Progression to solid.
Yeah. Yeah, more high signal noise, more parts of the sky, that's always good. Yeah. Well, MAP's not so helpful since it only goes up to 90 gigahertz. MAP's the killer bullet for the spinning dust, right? But for this kind of stuff, it's no help. But this is a good reason to build Planck. You know, Douglas asked earlier if we still need Planck, and we do. All right, Andrew?
I'm along the same lines of a purely statistical question about the fit. I mean, how correlated are the different, are the four parameters? Or are there really four parameters, or is it just as good as two temperature model?
I think I have the contour plot that shows the covariance of the parameters in my backpack there, but the parameters are separate. I thought you were going to ask about the covariance between different frequency bins of FIRAS, and we were very careful to handle the covariance matrix properly. I'm not embarrassed to invert a covariance matrix in public. So I think we dealt with the covariances. Yeah, there is sort of a degeneracy between the F and the Q, the emission fraction and the emissivity, the optical to submillimeter ratios. But it's not a horrible degeneracy. I mean, you are actually measuring two things there. Well, yes and no. Yes, if you allow the temperatures to float with respect to each other along each line of sight. So in our paper we have the table of chi-squareds for eight different models, one of them being two-component new squared model. And that scored a 10 in reduced chi-squared, and ours is 1.5 or something. But that's where we forced the two new squared components. They were different temperature because of different emissivity ratios. But we forced those to be fixed across the whole sky, just so we weren't comparing a model with 4 free parameters to one with a million free parameters or something. You know. But if you let all those things float, you can get an excellent fit. Right. We were just trying to use the bare minimum number of parameters and get something that's a good fit. And if you do that, then the two-component, both new squared model is significantly worse. So, but still, much better than any single power law model. That's, there are different degrees of badness here. Okay. Is that it? All right.